had? How much would I have? And were you one of those citizens sitting on the wall and taking it all in for free, what would you be thinking about now? Well, you'd be thinking, we're goners. We don't have a chance. Well, this man's wiped away every vestige of any kind of a defense that we could possibly have. Well, Eliakim, this is about all he could think of to come back with, apparently. Then said Eliakim and Shebna and Joah unto Rabshakeh, speak, I pray thee, unto thy servants in the Syrian language, for we understand it, and speak not unto us in the Jews' language, in the ears of the people that are on the wall. So the first thing he could think of was, speak in a different language. Stop speaking in this Jewish language, which all these people are sitting on the wall can understand. Speak to us in the language of the Syrians. Which would be the Armenian language. But all he could do was say, talk in a different language where these people can understand this. Speak in a language that we can understand and we can keep this thing more confidential, more private. Well, there were some powerful, compelling arguments here. Well, all that did was just make Rabshakeh go all that much worse. That really set him on. He saw he was getting to Eliakim. He saw that he was hitting home, and so he didn't let up at all. He got a lot worse than he was. So in the next verse, but Rabshakeh said, hath my master sent me to thy master and to thee to speak these words? Hath he not sent me to the men that sit upon the wall, that they may eat their own dung and drink their own piss with you? This was his retaliation. Now this verse is a crude, indelicate verse. But we want to deal with it because it I think, says a whole lot. He says, I wasn't sent just to speak to you and to your master, but I was also sent to speak to these men that sit on the wall. And then he, in a very undignified and improper, blasphemous way, tells them just what they have in store for them. To siege a city was usually a several month or several year affair. Nebuchadnezzar laid the siege up to Tyre for 12 years. And we just had some sieges by this very army in Egypt, and they were now had Lachish under siege. And it meant that the people would be starving. Parents would be eating their own babies. And so he describes them here as having to eat their own excrement and to drink their own urine. He said, these people on the wall, that's what they're destined to do. That's what's going to happen to them. In 2 Chronicles 32, verse 11, it's worded a little bit different. I mean, the thought is given there, but it's in a lot different words. Doth not Hezekiah persuade you to give over yourselves to die by famine and by thirst, saying, the Lord our God shall deliver us out of the hand of the king of Assyria? So it's another way of saying you're going to die by famine and by thirst. Now let's say just a few words about the reason for this kind of language to be found in the Bible. There are those who would be quite critical and quite shocked and upset with this wording. But let us remember that many articles of great literature, such as those of Shakespeare and Byron and so on, these same shocked, highly elite, critical people of the Bible will go sit in a theater and pay good money and hear words much worse than this and think it's great literature. Let us also remember that the statement here is the thought here is not an moral thought. It's just the words that are used. And words from one generation to another generation change in their ability to shock and to be immoral and improper. And words from one country and one culture to another country and another culture also change. And from one time to another time. At the time this was stated, it might have been very proper language. But let us also remember that these words are not the words of Isaiah the prophet. These words are the words of Reb Shekah, who was a bloodthirsty, power-hungry, murderous official in the Assyrian army. To use blasphemous, degrading, mind-boggling, immoral language, it's pretty common stuff for a marauding, killing army. Any person who's ever been in the army can tell you that. They get so that the most vile of words and thoughts and expressions are of no consequence and no shock at all because they hear it every day all the time. And so here's a man who has this kind of a background, whose only thought is to show his vicious, malicious, and powerful murderous side. Here he is presenting himself to these frightened people on the wall of Jerusalem, and all Isaiah is doing is recording what he says. So after having been asked not to speak in the language that the people could understand, this made him worse. Then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language, this is the Hebrew language, and said, "Hear ye the words of the great king, the king of Assyria." Listen to what the great king has to say. You're listening to the king that is the great king. He has subdued Egypt and Syria, and he's coming after you. He's not like Hezekiah, a little monarch that has no power. This is the great king. Here's what he says to you. "Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you." And I believe Second Kings says he shall not be able to deliver you out of his hand. So Hezekiah is deceiving you, you people. Don't let him deceive you. He'll not be able to deliver you. "Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria." Don't let Hezekiah tell you that. Don't let him deceive you in trusting in the Lord. Now, one thing about God's people is, as long as they trust in the Lord, there is no enemy, there is no foe, no power that's able to overcome them. You cannot be defeated as long as you trust in the Lord. And so the devil knows that in order to undermine God's people, all he really has to do is simply get you to stop trusting in the Lord. Well, this man, Rabshakeh, had been very happy for him trusting in Egypt. He don't mind trusting in Egypt at all. Or trust in their own power, their own fortifications, their own little, well, they didn't even have a cavalry. And he had a pool of water out there he'd built a wall around. Such pitiful, weak, and miserable defenses. But to trust in the Lord, that was the one thing he didn't want. So he says, "Hearken not to Hezekiah. For thus saith the king of Assyria." Now here's the proposition the king of Assyria is making to you. And no doubt Eliakim and Shebna and Joah, they were in a state of utter humiliation. All they could do is stand there and listen to the lecture. Here's the proposition the king of Assyria has made. "Make an agreement with me by a present." Now this implies that you make an agreement with me by giving me something here, and I'll agree to make an agreement with you. "And come out to me," and this phrase "come out to me" means surrender. You surrender to me, "and eat ye every one of his vine, and every one of his fig tree, and drink ye every one of the waters of his own cistern." You make an agreement with me, you surrender to me, and I'll let you be safe and secure. You can eat your own vine, you can drink the waters of your own cistern, and you can eat of your own fig tree. Now that would seem like a welcome relief. Oh, just to have him leave us alone. Let us stay where we are. You know, sometimes we think we are not satisfied with where we are. But whenever somebody's fixing to come in and destroy everything you've got and haul you away or destroy you too, you begin to think, well, this is a pretty good place, and he's going to let me stay here. But there was another hitch to it. Until I come and take you away to a land like your own, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards. So what he's really proposing here is, it's not as good, actually, as it sounds like on the surface. You make an agreement with me by a present, and you come out, or you surrender to me, and I let every man have his own fig tree, I let every man have his own sister, and I let every man eat of his own vine for a time. But I'm going to come and take you away. Well, no doubt this is when he finished the siege of Lachish, when he got his army all together and he came on through the country. Jerusalem would already have been completely subdued and surrendered. They'd used a little bit of freedom there for a while, but they had forfeited everything else. And then when he came through, he was going to take them away to a land, and he describes it as a land like your own, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards. Now, it was the customary thing of that day and even for centuries after that. The customary thing, when one country subdued another country or subdued a city of another country, the customary thing was to haul the people away from there captive. They hauled them away either as slaves or they hauled them away as a result of their triumph and to show their victory, or they hauled them away to prevent them from revolting against their power. They'd leave the little people, but the big, powerful, rich, influential people, they carried them out. Now, some of these were carried to new frontiers as colonists to colonize territory that this power had now occupied. Some of them were carried back to the homeland, and they're used in a slave capacity. But it was a customary thing. And so to surrender meant they were going to leave home anyway. And this very thing had already happened to Syria. Syria had been carried away by Assyria. They'd already been put into captivity and scattered asunder. But he used an enticing word. He said, I'll come and take you away to a land like your own land. I can't improve on this, really. A land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards. Beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. And he keeps getting back to this argument against the Lord delivering them. That's his main thing to fight against, and he knows it. He used every argument he can think of. The fact that Hezekiah has torn down his altar, the fact that the Lord's given him command to come there, the fact that the Lord wasn't any stronger than the other gods. That's the argument he's going to use right now. Hath any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? These other nations, were they able to deliver? Was their God able to deliver them from my king? In 2 Chronicles 32:19, this same thought is given in a very good word. And they spake against the God of Jerusalem, as against the gods of the people of the earth, which were the work of the hands of man. That's a very common mistake for people to make. They speak against the true and living God the same way that they would speak against the gods of the lands of the earth that are the works of men's hands. They treat the living God like they treat an idolatrous God. They don't know the difference. And so that's what Reb Shekah was doing. He was treating the living God, putting him in the same category as these idolatrous gods of the other nations who had been unable to defend themselves against him. So he asked the question, where are the gods of Hamath and Arphad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? These three cities that he names here are cities of Samaria. And it was a matter of record as to how Assyria had already captured Syria. And so he refers to that. Where are the gods of these cities? Hamath and Arphad and Sepharvaim. Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Oh, he took Samaria anyway. Who are they among all the gods of these lands that have delivered their land out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? Has it ever been done before? Has any other god ever saved their people before? And so who is your God to think that he can do what these other gods have all failed to do? But they held their peace. Now, whenever we got to this point of the speech, apparently Rabshakeh had presented all of his arguments now. And it was time for a rebuttal from the men of Hezekiah. But they held their peace and answered him not a word. For the king's commandment was saying, answer him not. The king had commanded, answer him not. In Proverbs, verse 4, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like unto him. This man was beyond all reason, all rationalization. He couldn't understand the nature of the true God. He didn't know really what kind of power Jerusalem had. And so any answer that he might give could be maybe brilliantly defeated by the rationale and reasoning that Rabshakeh was using. And the king had commanded, answer him not. Then came Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, that was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph, the recorder, to Hezekiah with their clothes rent, and told him the words of Rabshakeh. Now, to rent or tear the clothes was a common means used to express utter grief. What were they grieving about? What had Rabshakeh been talking about? He'd been talking about surrender, about having the city sieged, starving to death, dying of thirst. At the best, captivity. The best terms he had to offer were, surrender and I'll take you captive. Also blasphemy of God, comparing God to an idolatrous God, and blasphemy of the king, reproach of the king Hezekiah. They had not one shred of anything good to go back and tell Hezekiah. As a matter of fact, I imagine when they went back to Hezekiah, if it had been me, my first words would have been, it's a lot worse than we thought it was. He might have thought they had a little hope when he went out there, but after this speech, it's worse than it ever was. We don't have any escape. We're surely doomed to destruction. Now, God was using Assyria for the purpose of bringing this rebellious and this hypocritical people to their knees, for the purpose of causing them to turn loose of false security and to turn to and to depend upon God. And so after this speech and after this threat and all this power, this armor rattled in their face, so to speak, if there ever was a time that they were going to turn to God, now would be the time. So they come back to Hezekiah with their clothes rent, and they told him what Rabshakeh had said. And so we're going to see in the next chapter where Hezekiah then goes and he takes it to the Lord. He spreads his problem out before the Lord. And he goes to the right source. And he seeks aid from the one and only source that could at this time help him. There was not another power under heaven that could help Hezekiah other than the Lord. And there are times, there are going to be times with us in which our back's going to be to the wall. There's not going to be another power under the face of heaven that can help us. But this same Lord, to whom Hezekiah and his frightened nation now turn. So we'll conclude at that verse, and next time, Lord willing, begin with the 37th chapter. Anybody have any questions or any comments up to this point?
Wouldn't this have been another insult to Rabbi Sheka to not give him an answer, asking his questions, him with all that power here, playing whatever he had to speak with him, to remain quiet after he comes with all this speech and all this promotion that he's doing, and then saying, you know, you better rely on me?
Well, it might have been an insult, and then on the other hand, it might have been a sign of weakness. Because to me, it seems to me that Rabbi Sheka, whenever they asked him not to speak in the language of the Jewish people, he saw he was getting to him right then. And he immediately began to direct his speech away from Eliakim and to the people on the wall. And if rumors spread anything then, like they do in Hamilton, I guarantee you it wasn't long until that little speech was all over town. He'd hit home. And this not retaliating might just very likely have been a sign of weakness to Rabbi Sheka. I don't know. I can't say. But you got to give the man credit for having been quite a psychologist, in that he knew what points to use. He was a pretty good debater here. He knew the key points, and he used his argument to the hilt. He didn't neglect the subject of God. He brought God up several times. Reasons why they shouldn't depend upon God. Reasons why they shouldn't depend upon Egypt. And reasons why they themselves didn't even have a cavalry to fight with. I'd have felt pretty weak myself, other than my reliance upon God. That's true. The logical thing, if they were really going to rely upon God, and the king had already said not to answer him. That was the command of the king. The logical thing was, let's hear what the man's got to say, and then let's take it to God and hear what God has to say. Because they were agents of God. And, you know, that's essentially the same position we're in today. Anytime somebody challenges us, we can hear somebody else's argument, and then we have to go to the Bible to test it and see what the Bible says about the thing. Our own think-sos are not necessarily right. Our own prejudices are not necessarily right. But what is, does the Bible condone this doctrine, or does it condemn it? And all Hezekiah could do would be just to go to God. And they had no idea, no inkling, that God was going to kill 187,000 Assyrians one night as they laid outside the wall of Jerusalem. They didn't know that that was going to happen. They could not foresee that at this time. Oh yeah, it wouldn't have
phased.
No, it wouldn't have phased them at all. And the important thing is, had they known it, would their own people have even believed it? You know, that's the big thing. Would the God's people have believed it even? We're not worried about the world believing what God says, but we're worried about the church believing what God says, though, for sure. Well, if there's nothing further, why, we'd like to dismiss with a prayer. We'd like to ask Kenneth, if he would, to dismiss us with a prayer.
God in heaven, we're so thankful to thee for this day, for the opportunity and privilege that we have to gather together and study thy word. Pray that you'll help us, and that we'll study thy word from time to time, to have a love for it, and to respect it, and to treat it as we should, and to obey its every command. Help us in our every facet of life, Father, that we would look to thy word as a guide for our lives. Pray that you would forgive us for our shortcomings and weaknesses, and strengthen us for our faith and temptation. We ask in Jesus' name.